The Jewish Game of Thrones, right? That's what the Shear's title.
Yeah, a lot of okay. people like wrote down like on the schedule.
Yeah.
Like that, like it's like embarrassment or something like that.
Okay, whatever. I mean, we're gonna talk about the Book of Kings, right? Yeah. So the Book of Kings is one of the books of the Tanakh, of the written Torah. As you probably know, the word Tanakh stands for, is an acronym for Torah, Nevi'im, Uksuvim. The Torah is the five books of Moses. The Nevi'im are the books of the prophets. And the Ksuvim are things that were written not with the same level of prophecy, but they are also writings that are included in Tanakh, in the what we collectively call the Bible, the 24 books of the Bible. So Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim. Nevi'im consists of, just to give you a little bit of a background to what we're talking about, Nevi'im consists of sort of two categories of books of Nevi'im. There's the historical books of Nevi'im, and then there's what they call the literary books of Nevi'im. So the historical books of Nevi'im talk about the story of what happened from the time that Moses died all the way down to the destruction of the first temple. Right? So that's a span of close to 1,000 years. That's that's what the historical books of the Nevi'im talk about. That's Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, and Melachim. Those are the historical books of the Nevi'im. And the not historical, but the literary books of the Nevi'im, the literary prophecies, are more abstract ideas and visions that different prophets had. There are a few stories here and there in those books, but for the most part, it's not a historical narrative. It's not in the context of a historical narrative. It's more just abstract visions and prophecies and rebukes of the people. So those books include, you know, the books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and then the book of the 12 prophets, which is one book that has prophecies of 12 different prophets. They call it the minor prophets. I don't know who decided that they're minor. They're not really minor prophets. We don't call them minor prophets. They just call Treasar, the 12 prophets. For some reason, people like to call them the minor prophets. I don't know why they're minor. They're not minor. They just happens to be that their prophecies are, let's say, smaller. So we put them together so that you won't lose all of them. So we put them together in one book. That's a general outline of the prophets. And then there's the Ksuvim, which is various writings that are also in Tanakh. It varies from, let's say, Shir Shirim, which on the surface is a love story, to Proverbs and Kehelas, which is part of what they call the wisdom literature, and then you have a few even historical things in the Ksuvim, in the writings of Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Devar Yomim. It also gets into history, and then there's a few other random things that are in Ksuvim. You know, the story of Job is in Ksuvim, the story of Ruth is in Ksuvim, different things that are in Ksuvim. So we're going to focus on the Book of Kings, which, if you want to be archaic, they used to call the Book of Kings the Book of Regents. A regent is the Book of Kings. So, like, if you want to be fancy, so you could sometimes call it the Book of Regents. As you probably know, the Book of Kings is split into two. There's, you know, Kings 1 and Kings 2. So that split is really an artificial split, like all the 1 and 2s that we find in the Bible. Really, and according to our Masoret, it's called one book. It's called Sefer Melachim, the Book of the Kings. Later on, Christian scholars, I believe it was Jerome, although it could be that Jerome was the guy who made the chapters in the Bible. So he either made the chapters or he made the books. But he took certain books in the Bible that he decided were too long, and he split them into two. So it's like Samuel was really one book, and he decided what makes Samuel to Samuel 1 and Samuel 2. So Kings also, Kings 1 and Kings 2, he made it into Kings 1 and Kings 2. Chronicles, he made Chronicles 1 and Chronicles 2. He also split Ezra and Nehemiah into two books. But according to our tradition, it's really considered one book. Well, there is a two when it comes to the kings, and that is the fact that at a certain point in history, there became two kingdoms. And that's something that we'll discuss as we develop what was through the history of the kings, that there were going to be two kingdoms. There's what's called the Kingdom of Israel and the Kingdom of Judah. So this is a map over here of the Holy Land. Everyone can get one if you want. The Kingdom of Judah consisted of the area of the tribal territory of Judah and Benjamin, and the Kingdom of Israel consisted of the rest of the Holy Land. Okay, we'll get to that. We're sort of jumping the gun. But
what's the difference? I mean, like,
Well, no, we'll see. Well, there were two kingdoms, and there were separate political entities, mm-hmm. and sometimes they were allied, and sometimes they were fighting each other, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, even though we'll see, but we'll talk more about it as it comes up. But I just want to give a little bit of a more general historical context of where we're up to over here. So we know, we're probably familiar with the story of the Parshas in the Chumash, all the way down to where Moshe Rabbeinu dies when the Jews are in the desert. They're about to enter the Holy Land and Moshe Rabbeinu dies. So continuing from that narrative is where the book of Joshua picks up and talks about, throughout the book of Joshua, talks about the Jewish people under the leadership of Joshua, Yeshua, where basically he leads the people into the Holy Land, spends time conquering and dividing the land between the tribes. He was either the leader for 28 years or for 14 years. Different sources vary exactly how long his leadership lasted. But that was the story of Joshua. And that's the book of Joshua, which the tradition tells us he himself wrote, except for the last few verses, which describe his death, which he didn't write. Then after the book of Joshua is the book of Judges. The book of Judges continues after the death of Joshua. Different leaders that the Jewish people had. This is a period of close to 400 years of different leaders, let's say more like 300 years of different leaders that the Jewish people had, the different judges. Almost each tribe had a judge from its ranks that was the judge over the entire people. But the leaders of the Jewish people at that time were the judges. And the book of Judges talks about all the different stories and things that happened there. The last of the judges was somebody named Eli HaKoyen, who was actually a Kohen. He was a Kohen Gadol as well, and he was the leader of the Jewish people for 40 years. And upon his death, so his student Shmuel HaNavi became in charge of the Jewish people. He was the leader, and Shmuel HaNavi was also a judge, and there's a street named after him over here in Yerushalayim. Shmuel HaNavi was the one who, towards the end of his life, so the Jewish people asked him for a king. They said, we want to have a king over ourselves, just like the Goyim have a king. Each non-Jewish nation has their own king, so we also want to have our own king. So Shmuel Avi says, okay, fine. So Hashem says to Shmuel Avi, don't be insulted. They're not rejecting your leadership. They're really rejecting my leadership, whatever that means, because they wanted to have a king over themselves instead of just having Hashem. They also wanted to have a human king, whatever exactly that entails. But they asked for a king, so Hashem gave a king, and Hashem sent Shmuel HaNavi to go anoint somebody named Shaul, or Saul, as the king. Now, Saul is from actually the tribe of Benjamin. Usually the kings are supposed to be from the tribe of Yehuda, as Yaakov Avinu said to Yehuda on his deathbed. He gave him a bracha. He said, Lo yosur shevet mi Yehuda. The scepter shall never be removed from Yehuda ad ki yovei Shela, until Shela comes. And Chazal tell us that Shela is another name for Mashiach. So until Mashiach comes, you know, all the kings are supposed to be from Yehuda. But the first king was actually not from Yehuda. The first king was from Binyamin. And that was Shaul ben Kish. And he was a king for 2 years. And more or less what happened was that he didn't live up to the expectations that Hashem had had for the first king of Bnei Yisrael. There's three halachas that the Jews are commanded to do when they come into Eretz Yisrael. One is to have a king, one is to destroy a Malik, and one is to build the Beis HaMikdash. So Shaul was charged with destroying a Malik, and he didn't live up to that expectation. Whatever, I don't want to get into all the details. In what area exactly he failed to live up to? Where exactly did he mess up? But the point is that he didn't actually end up killing out all of Amalek, and he didn't listen to the prophet Shmuel as he was supposed to, and therefore he lost the kingship. And Shmuel HaNavi, Hashem told Shmuel HaNavi to anoint somebody else instead of Shaul, and that was actually Shaul's son-in-law David, who became the king afterwards. That's David HaMelech. The book of Kings begins with David HaMelech as an old man and discusses the question of succession. Who's going to be the king after David HaMelech? That's the opening of the book of Kings. What I want to do before we get to that is we're going to try to get a little bit of a more of a background of that question. Who is supposed to succeed David HaMelech? And we'll open up the question a little bit more, and we'll see who the different contenders were, and what the question was. And in doing that, we're going to first analyze two of what I think are the most controversial stories in the book of Samuel. Well, first of all, let's just get a general background of who we're looking at. Who are the different people that could be the king? So, when we talk about King David, so Chazal tell us, first of all, you should know that the Torah imposes three limits on a king. Right? There's three prohibitions that apply specifically to a king in Halacha. This is mentioned in Sefer Dvarim in Parshas Kisetzeh. In Parshas Shoftim, it says that a king is not allowed to have too many wives, he's not allowed to have too many horses, and he's not allowed to have too much gold and silver. The reason is because if you have too many wives, then it can you might be strayed after whatever non-straight inclinations they might have, especially if they're not from the Jewish people. The reason for the horses, the Torah says, is because I guess the major exporter of horses in the ancient world was Egypt, and Hashem didn't want the Jews to end up going back to Egypt, so he said, put a limit on how many horses a king could have so that he won't end up bringing people back to Egypt to bring horses. And gold and silver as well, if a person's main pursuit in life is chasing after gold and silver, it causes them to deviate from focusing on service of Hashem, and that's not a good thing for a king to undergo. So those are the three prohibitions that apply to a king. So David HaMelech had altogether 18 wives. And Chazal learned from that, or Chazal had a Masara, had a tradition that says that when it says that a king is not allowed to have too many wives, the limit is 18. So David HaMelech had 18 wives, and that was the maximum amount of wives that a king was allowed to have. Okay, so who were David HaMelech's children? So obviously if he had 18 wives, he had a lot of different children. Well, who would you assume would be his successor?
Firstborn,
right? Okay, so we're still a little bit in the book of Samuel, Samuel 2, chapter 3. It lists the sons of King David. Do we have a marker here, maybe an eraser? Let's put them on the board. The first son of King David. I should write it in English or in Hebrew?
English.
Okay. Hebrew. The first son is named
Gam Vigam.
Amnon. That's the first son. His name is Amnon, and he was the son of David HaMelech's first wife, whose name was Achinoam of Israel. His name was Kilab. His third son was named Avshalom. Fourth son was named Adoniyahu. This is fourth one. The fifth son was named Shefatia ben Avital, which is interesting. The Gemara actually says that Rabbi Yudah Nasi, the one who codified the Mishnah, was a descendant of Shefatia ben Avital. That's what the Gemara says. His sixth son was Yisram, etc. So these are the Navi in Shmuel Beis Per Gimel lists the six oldest sons of King David. So the question is, who's going to be his successor? So you would assume that it's going to be Amnon. So we're going to see that Amnon is not going to be his successor. I'm not sure if we're not going to probably get to it today, but hopefully Sunday we'll get to the story of Amnon. The second son, Kilav, is very interesting. The Gemara says that David HaMelech had a Rebbe. His name was Mipi Baishas. And Mipi Baishas was either a son or a grandson of Shaul HaMelech. And Mipi Boshes was a big Talmud Chacham, and he was such a big Talmud Chacham that he eclipsed David HaMelech. The Gemara says that he sort of embarrassed David HaMelech in his mastery of Torah that David HaMelech didn't have. And Chazal tells us that because David HaMelech was sort of humble and he allowed himself to be eclipsed in Torah scholarship by this person, Mipi Boshes, so David HaMelech merited to have a son who was a huge Talmud Chacham, greater than everyone else in his generation, and his name was Kilav. And actually, the Gemara says that his name wasn't really Kilav, his name was really Daniel, but he was called Kilav as a allusion to what I just said. For some reason, Kilav is not in the, he's not one of the contenders. He's not in the running at all. And nothing is really mentioned of him in all of Tanakh. We just mentioned his name. We don't really talk anything else about him. So I'm not sure why we don't know anything about him and why he's not one of the runners for the kingship. But you could say that maybe he died young, and maybe that's why he wasn't one of the contenders. Or you could say that maybe he was so into his Torah learning that he wasn't even interested in becoming king at all. I'm not sure if you could say that, but I just, because of the question, like why isn't he on the list of the contenders? The third son, Avshalom, is definitely one of the contenders to be king, and we're going to see more about that later. And the fourth one, Adoniyahu, is also definitely one of the contenders to be king. Now, as we probably know, none of these actually became king. Who really became king was Shlomo Melech, King Solomon, and we will hopefully get to that when we actually start the Book of Kings. So that's sort of the background of where we're coming from here. Now, I said that David Melech had 18 wives, right? We're going to look at the story of how David Melech married his 18th wife, and we're going to see, we're going to talk about the birth of Shlomo Melech.
Sorry, do you have another hand up?
Haredi people with their handouts. You got one?
I got
two. Okay. Fine. So we're going to be looking at today Shmuel Beis, the second book of Samuel, chapter 11. This is a story of David and Bathsheba. This is one of the controversial stories in the Bible. So, as the story goes, King David was once going out on the roof, and he saw a beautiful lady there bathing on her roof. Now, of course, the question is like, what you think? David Melech was looking on the roof and checking out all the ladies over there. He was looking for it. So the Gemara tells us that, you know, the Satan has his ways of calling attention to things in a way that you might not have otherwise been looking at it, but it just pops up in your face in a certain way. The Gemara says that David Melech saw a bird over there, and he wanted to shoot the bird with his arrow. And as he tried to shoot the bird with his arrow, and ended up missing the bird. And what he did was, he actually hit a beehive. And that beehive was what was blocking the view of this beautiful woman. Now that he knocked down the beehive with his arrow, he was able to see this beautiful woman. It's not that he was focusing on her beforehand and then he noticed her. He was focusing on trying to hit this bird with an arrow, and he ended up seeing this beautiful woman bathing on the rooftop. Her name was Bathsheba. Bathsheba Bas Elyoim. And Bathsheba was actually the granddaughter of one of King David's advisors. His name was Achitophel. She was a granddaughter of King David's advisor, Achitophel. And he wanted to be with her because she was very beautiful. So he sent messengers and he took her and he laid with her and she returned to her house. Now, the problem is that the next step, she sends a message to him and says that she became pregnant. Another problem is she's married. She's married to a fellow named Uriah Hachiti. Right? So what does David HaMelech do? We're going to have to analyze what was motivating him and what was the halachic justification for what he does. What he does is he calls in his general, Yoav, and he tells the general, send me this fellow, Uriah Hachiti, who's in my army, and I want to speak to him. We're in the middle of a war, so he sends in, I believe they were fighting, does it say who they were fighting? It actually doesn't say who they were fighting. They were in the middle of some anonymous war. They were in the middle of some war with some anonymous people, and he sends forth for this Yoav. He gets Yoav to send this Uriah guy to himself, and he speaks to Uriah and he says to Uriah, "Oh, how's the war coming along?" And, you know, Uriah says, yeah, you know, we're having this war here. And David HaMelech says, you know, maybe you should go home, relax, spend some time with your wife, you know, and, you know, enjoy yourself, take a little break, and then you can go back to the fighting. And then the guy, okay, so then he, King David dismisses him, right? What does he do? He doesn't go home. He sleeps in the entrance to the king's house. He doesn't go back home. And they told King, they told David HaMelech that Uriah, the man that you sent home, he didn't go home. So David HaMelech calls Uriah back the next morning. He says, why didn't you go home? And Uriah says to him, how could it be that my men, my soldiers, my fellow soldiers are out, they're fighting in the war, and I'm going to go home and enjoy my family and lie with my wife and eat these foods and drinks? I can't do that. I can't do such a thing. I can't, like, forsake my people. I have to show my unity with them. So I slept over here on the floor by the king's entrance. I didn't go home. Fine. So the king says, okay, fine. You can go back to your battles, right? Fine. And see, on the side, the king sends a message to Yoav, the head of the army, and he says to Yoav, see this, you know this guy Uriah Hittite? So you should send him to the front lines and have everyone else retreat, but make sure he doesn't get the message. And that's what happens. Yoav sends Uriah Hittite to the front lines. Everyone retreats. Uriah obviously gets killed because he was left by himself on the battlefield, and that seems to be the end of the story. Right? Uriah dies, and she mourns her husband, and after the days of mourning, so David HaMelech sends a message for her, and he brings her to her house, and he marries her, and now she's his wife. That's David HaMelech's 18th wife, and the end of the pasuk says, the last pasuk in Perek Yud Aleph says, Vayera Adover Asher Asa David Be'eni Hashem, and the matter which David had done was bad in the eyes of Hashem. Fine. So this is more or less the simple understanding of the story over here. We'll get to the continuation of the story afterwards. But this is the simple understanding of what happened. Any questions?
Did you for a fact that he died in battle, there was no issue of like Alman or anything?
What?
Basho was definitely not Almana,
right? They knew for a fact that she was a widow and not like a slave
widow. No, yeah, for sure. I mean, we know that he died. Oh, yeah. Okay. Wait, how was he allowed to sleep with her before he was sent her off to battle?
Oh, right. That's the obvious question, right? How come you're the only guy asking it?
I know that.
What?
I was just learning with Shlomi actually about this. And
yeah.
Before they went off to battle, the soldiers would leave their wives again secretly in case they went missing and come back.
In case they died, though. But it was if they died, though, if they died in battle, then the get would be activated. But before the get.
Yeah, in case they went missing instead of dying, so they disappeared.
Yeah, but that wasn't
if
the case.
If they died, they don't need the get.
So that means in case they just went their body.
But that wasn't the case. So the get would be activated.
So you have to know exactly the wording. Okay, so with the uninitiated. So basically, the Gemara doesn't actually address this issue directly, but in a sort of tangential way answers this question. The Gemara says, how is it that King David is... We'll explain how the Gemara says it differently, but we're asking the question, how is King David able to live with Bathsheba? She's a married woman, and it's considered, in other words, adultery, right? So the answer that we can take from the Gemara is that the custom amongst the soldiers of King David's army was that when they would go out to battle, they would give a get to their wives, they would give a bill of divorce to their wives. If you word it like this, I think it'll answer your issue. The divorce was stipulated that if they don't return back from at the end of the battle, then the divorce should be effectuated from now. That's basically the way to answer your question. So he didn't end up coming back. So that divorce that he gave her on the condition that he doesn't come back came into effect, let's say retroactively, from while he was initially at battle, and then David was sort of post facto justified in what he did.
Okay, it's still there.
Well, Yeah, let's say there's still an avera involved, and we're going to see in the continuation that the Navi is aware that there's an avera and reprimands King David for it, and you'll see how David and Melch reacts in the continuation of the story. Okay, the other issue that you guys, I'm surprised no one asked that, was how could King David arrange for this guy's death? You know, that's also not a nice thing to do. You can't just like arrange, tell everyone to, you know, everyone retreat, and don't tell him to retreat, and he ends up getting killed in the battle. What, you know, how is David Melch justified in doing that? So the Gemara in Shabbos says that there's a halacha that a person who rebels against the king is chayiv misa. He can be killed. So when David Melch told Uriah, "Oh, why don't you go home, return to your wife, you know, enjoy a little respite from the fighting," and he didn't do that. He instead slept in the king's courtyard, in front of the king's palace. So by doing that, he was disobeying a direct command from the king. So he was chayiv misa. So David Melch was justified in killing him.
That's ridiculous. He was messing with him.
What?
He was messing with him when he said that.
Was he messing with him?
He was messing with him.
What was he trying to do? Let's ask that question. What was he trying to do?
He was trying to get his wife.
So why did he tell the guy to come home?
Because he knew the answer that you would give him.
So you're saying he trapped him?
Yeah.
It could be. But at the end of the day, he did rebel against the king. Let's say he trapped him. But at the end of the, and he, let's say for some reason he knew that that's how Uriah would react, that he wouldn't go home. Which is not so clear, that why would you think that he would do that? I mean,
would he abandon his soldiers?
Yeah, but usually if you're a soldier and someone gives you, and your commanding officer gives you a break, you take the break. You don't say, "No, everyone else is fighting, I want to go fight with them," right?
Maybe the commanding officer and you're like invested in the war.
Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't think it was 100% to him that this would happen. I don't know. Could be you're right. But even let's say you're right, that he set him up. But at the end of the day, he did rebel against the king.
What? Tom McLaughlin would know that that would be the response of his soldier. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Maybe. You could be right. But even if you're right, he's still rebelling against the king.
Wasn't it more like a suggestion, though? That's the way I heard it. Like, was it a command? Or like, you know, you should go home? And is that like a command? Or?
It could be the way I said it. It sounded more like a suggestion. I was maybe toning down the expression. But if you look in the psukim, the way he says it is, Reid levescha urchatz raglacha. Go down to your house and wash your feet. And washing your feet is like a euphemism for like living with your wife, right? So that sounds like a direct command. Could be I toned it down a little bit, but it was certainly a direct command. Okay. The other issue, and this is what the Gemara really really asks. The Gemara in Ksuba stuff tests. There's a halacha that if a woman is unfaithful to her husband, she has relations with a man other than her husband, so the halacha is she's forbidden to both her husband and to that man. Meaning, let's say she's married to X and she cheats on X with Y, right? So she's forbidden to continue being married to X. X has to divorce her, but also she's not allowed to be with Y anymore. So like if X divorces her, she's not allowed to go and marry Y, right? She's forbidden to X and to Y.
So he'd given the limit for a get that wasn't activated yet. Then David was with Bathsheba. Then David sent him to go be with Bathsheba in Isser. And then sent him to go die. Then Lenafrea, David was actually not with her in Isser.
No, it doesn't work.
Retroactively, he was not really considering a vera retroactively. The get was in place, and if the get was in place,
right, that, before, but that
was his way out. He found a loophole in the system.
Right. Okay, but the Gemara asks like this. The Gemara asks that if the adulterer, the adulteress is forbidden to both her husband and to the adulterer, so then how is it that David HaMelech was able to marry her after he had committed what seems to be adultery with her? That's what the Gemara's question is. How could he marry her afterwards? That marriage should be forbidden. So to that, the Gemara gives two answers. The Gemara says this idea of the get, which we extrapolated from that answer, a justification of how he was able to do it in the first place, how he was able to commit what we'd call quote-unquote adultery in the first place. And we said because he gave her a get beforehand that had this stipulation. The Gemara says a second answer. The Gemara's second answer is like this. This is, in a way, it's also a technicality, but it doesn't justify what David HaMelech actually did. It justifies how he can marry her afterwards. It doesn't justify what he did. But the halacha is that the prohibition of the adulteress to her husband and to the adulterer are interdependent. Meaning, if for whatever reason she's not going to become forbidden to her husband, then she won't become forbidden to the adulterer. So the halacha is like this. Let's say you have a married woman and she's raped by somebody. Yeah, she's forcibly in relations with another man. Right? So what's the halacha? So the halacha is, the Torah says, v'hi lo nispasa, if she wasn't grabbed or she wasn't captured, so that's when there's a prohibition for her to marry, to remain with her husband and to be with the adulterer. But if she was forced into it, so the halacha is that she's allowed to remain with her husband, and because she's allowed to remain with her husband, so then she's also allowed to, let's say at a later point, marry the adulterer. Let's say if her husband dies or if her husband subsequently divorces her, she's allowed to be with the adulterer.
You know, like David, a rapist?
What? Well, one second. We're gonna get to this. What's that? The idea behind this halacha is because if a woman is forced into it, the reason why she's prohibited to her husband, if she, let's say, cheats on her husband, is specifically because she cheated on him. She sort of rebelled against him. She showed that she's doing something against him. She's committing a crime against her husband. And so if she's forced into it, she hasn't committed a crime against her husband. Right? The crime was committed against her. She didn't do anything against her husband. Right? Therefore, she's going to be permitted to continue with her husband. And because the prohibition to the adulterer is dependent on the prohibition to her husband, so she would also be permitted to the adulterer for technical reasons. Right?
He had to rape her in order to have Hetter for marrying her later.
Let's so the Gemara says like this. The Gemara takes another step. Besides, the idea is that if a person goes and, let's say, a woman goes of her own volition and cheats on her husband, so then that creates a prohibition to both her husband and to the adulterer. But what happens if she doesn't do it of her own volition? Right? If she's forced, so we said, then that doesn't create any prohibitions. Now, the question is, what's considered of her own volition? What state of mind does she have to be in? So we say that she has to be at least of the age of majority in order to be able to make such a decision. She has to be at least 12 years old in order to decide this. Now, Chazal tell us that Bathsheba, even though she was married, she was less than the age that she would have the mental capacity, let's say, for making such a decision. She was under the age of 12, which was considered socially acceptable in that period of time. We can't understand it, but then it was considered socially acceptable. Not like Muhammad, which by his time, marrying 7-year-olds was completely ludicrous. But in this time, in this period of time, it was considered very normal. So what David HaMelech did was, so what happened was that the Gemara says that it's called pitoy ketana oinus. If you convince a ketana, a woman who's a minor, so that's considered as if you forced her. So this woman, even if David HaMelech convinced her, he didn't force her per se, but she wasn't in a state of mind that she could decide, is she rebelling against her husband or is she not rebelling against her husband? She's too young to be in the position to be able to make that decision. So therefore, even though I wouldn't say that King David raped her, but it would have the same consequences as rape, because she was statutory. No, that would be the appropriate term. That would be the appropriate term for it.
Was there a shita that because David was the king, she felt like she had no choice, so she's an onus and he isn't a rapist because he had some kind of convinced her?
It could be that there is such a shita. I don't remember seeing it offhand, but it could be that I vaguely remember such a thing, but I don't remember who or where it says that. It could be I was once thinking of such an idea, but I don't remember seeing it somewhere. But that's the second answer of the Gemara. The second answer of the Gemara is because she was a ketana, because she was so young, so therefore she never became prohibited to her husband, and that because she never rebelled against her husband, and therefore she's permitted to the quote unquote adulterer as well, and that's why David HaMelech was able to marry her afterwards. That's the Gemara's second answer. First answer was that Uriah HaChiti gave her a get previously, and therefore they weren't considered married, and therefore it wasn't adultery at all, and therefore David can marry her. And according to the second answer, it was considered technically adultery, but because she was too young to be considered rebelling against her husband, so she remained permitted to her husband, and because she remained permitted to her husband, she remained permitted to the adulterer as well, and therefore King David was allowed to marry her. That's the second answer in the Gemara. And the Gemara tells us that elsewhere, the Gemara says that Ru'uya Haisa Basheva LeDavid Misheshes Yimei Bereishis. Basheva was destined really to be the wife of King David all the way from the time of the 6 days of creation. This was something that Hashem had already set up, that she was destined to be his wife. It just it came about in a weird way, in a funny way, in a way that looked like there were different prohibitions involved, but ultimately that was the way it was supposed to be, that she was supposed to be sort of his soulmate. But I think that using that term is a bit cliche, but for lack of a better term, she was already his soulmate. Yeah, what do you want to say?
Yeah, just kind of a side question with Mara. Just curious, what if there's a situation where, let's say, the wife is like blackmailed and say, if you don't have sex with me, then whatever X is going to happen, but she still technically has a choice to do it or not. Does that count as being forced? Or it's still of her own volition? I don't know.
When the Torah talks about it, the Torah seems to be talking about a woman who's physically forced.
Right.
So, in the case of blackmail, I wouldn't say that she's necessarily forced. She just decided this is the lesser of two options.
Yeah, it's the same as my question, sort of.
Well,
it's similar to mine, that the king can coerce, but the king can also punish if.
Right. If you don't listen, yeah. So I wouldn't. It's not exactly the same thing. There is a medrash that says, this is an interesting medrash. The medrash says that one of the famous things that King David did was that he fought against the giant Goliath. Right, you know the story that Goliath came, who was taunting the Jews or whatever, and King David defeated him with a slingshot and a little rock. Right, and so there's a medrash that says that after King David used the rock to knock down the giant, so he wanted to kill him, right? But in order to chop off his head, so he needed to take off the guy's helmet. And this huge giant guy with this helmet affixed to his head, so how's King David going to get the helmet off of him? So the Medrash says that this great warrior named Uriah HaChiti came along, and he said, "Don't worry, I can take care of it." And he was able to get the helmet off of Goliath. I don't know exactly what he did, and why King David couldn't do that, but somehow Uriah HaChiti was able to get the helmet off of Goliath. And then King David said, "Wow, you're such a warrior. I'll give you a special prize. I'll give you this lady Bathsheba, who happens to be a granddaughter of one of my close advisors, Achitophel." That's what the Medrash says. And the Medrash says that Hashem's reaction to what King David did was, he said, "B'nai Sisrael ata machalik." Well, you're giving out Jewish girls. You're giving out they're like their prizes. Like, "Oh, I'll marry her because, you know, this isn't like some sort of medieval fairy tale where you slay the dragon and you get the girl. It doesn't work like that. You can't just give out women for free like that. That's not how it goes." So Hashem says, "Chayacha ishtacha nesun alai. Your wife, or the wife who's destined to be yours, is going to be given to this Uriah HaChiti." So David HaMelech thought, you know, he was giving him a prize, but really he was taking away from himself. This woman was really supposed to be destined to David HaMelech, and he ended up giving her away as a prize, and then ultimately she came back to him through this interesting story over here. There's another point that they talk about is what's the guy's name? What's her husband's name? Uriah HaChiti, right? What does that mean? Uriah the Chittite, right? So what's a Chittite? So Chitti is one of the seven Canaanite nations. The Chitti, oh, right? Yes. Etc. Chitti, Amori, Prizi, Yavusi, Right, so was Uriah Jewish? Was he not Jewish? Why is he called Uriah Chiti? So some commentators, the Gemara says, the reason why he's called Uriah Chiti is because he came from the land of Chis. He came from that territory which had previously been inhabited by the Canaanite nation of the Chitim. The Radak and others say that he's called Uriah Chiti because he was originally a Chiti and he converted to Judaism. He's a Ger. So he was called HaChiti because he was originally a Chiti. So according to these two explanations, he definitely was Jewish, and then all the questions that we had are in place, and we have to say all the, you would probably call them apologetic answers. Right? There is another approach that the Klei Yakar, Rav Shmuel Laniado, one of the great, when the early Achronim who wrote on Nach, so he brings an approach that says that Uriah Chiti wasn't even Jewish. He was literally a Chiti. He wasn't Jewish at all. So the fact that he was married to this Jewish lady, Bathsheba, it wasn't even a marriage that was, let's say, halachically recognized. So he wasn't cheating on her at all. So there wasn't any problem going out of here. That's another approach to sort of answer up some of the questions. What's the continuation of the story? So the story goes that Hashem sends the prophet Nason. Nason Hanavi comes to David HaMelech, and Nason Hanavi says to David HaMelech, I have a halacha question for you. This is, you know, through prophecy that Hashem told him to say this to bring out a point. He says, I have a halacha question for you. Let's say you have two people in a city. One is very rich and one is very poor. And the rich man, he has a lot of sheep and a lot of cattle. And the poor man, all he has is one little sheep that he bought, and it lives with him, and he raises this sheep with his as if it's with, you know, along with his children, and it eats from his bread, and it drinks from his cup, you know, and it sleeps with him in his bed at night, and he, you know, he treats this little sheep like it's a daughter. And one day the rich man had a guest, and the rich man decided, nope, I don't feel like using one of my own animals to slaughter one of my own animals and serve the meat for this important guest that I have. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to this poor guy next door. He has a sheep. I'll take his sheep, slaughter it, and I'll serve the meat for my guest. And that's what he does. He goes, he takes the sheep, he slaughters it, and he serves it for his guest. So Nasan HaNavi asks David HaMelech, what's the halacha? What's the halacha about this guy who took the poor man's sheep and slaughtered it? What's the halacha? What do you do with such a person? And David, the pasuk says, "Vayichayaf David ba'ish ma'id." David got very angry about such a guy, that the existence, that such a person could exist. David got very angry, and he said, "Chay Hashem, I swear by Hashem, ki ben mavis ha'ish ha'is azois. The person who did such a thing is a ben mavis. He's someone who's deserving of death." And then Nasan HaNavi drops the bombshell, and he says to him, "Vayomer Nasan al David, atoha ish. You are the man that you did exactly that. You're the rich man. You have 17 wives, right? And this guy has one wife. And what did you do? You took his wife away. What do you?" When David HaMelech responded originally, I skipped out the pasuk, but the lashon is David HaMelech said, "Ves hakvosim yishalem arbatayim." He should pay back four times the sheep, right? That's what David HaMelech said. He said, the guy should pay back four, the rich man should pay back four. It wasn't just the sheep that he stole, he should pay back four times the sheep.
That's halacha.
You're learning Bava Kama, so you know that's the halacha, right? Right. Right. Utvacha yumachara, if you steal and you shecht it, so and you slaughter it, you have to pay back four times the amount, right? That is the halacha. So David HaMelech said, you should pay back four times the amount. So we'll get to that point again, four times the amount. But so the Navi says to David HaMelech, "V'atah lo yisoser charev mibeischa ad olam." And now a sword shall not cease from your house forever, because you have insulted me. Hashem is saying, because you insulted me and you took the wife of Uriah Chiti as a wife. And he says, Hashem says, "Koyamar Hashem." The Navi Nelson says, "Koyamar Hashem, so said Hashem, hinini mekim alacha ra'a mi beisacha. Behold, I'm gonna raise against you evil from your house. And there's gonna be an evil that's gonna arise from your house against you." And Gemara says that when David HaMelech heard this, so he was sort of calmed down. He knew that he was going to get punished, but he figured that, you know, maybe his punishment is going to come from some foreign entity, from someone who's not related to him, and such a person won't have mercy. But when the Navi told him, your punishment is going to come from your house, someone from your house is going to be the punishment, so David HaMelech sort of calmed down, and he realized that, like, he's going to get punished, but it's not going to be so bad. And then it says, "Vayomer David al Nason chatasi l'Hashem." David confessed his sin. He said, "I have sinned to Hashem." And the Navi says to him that, "Fine, Hashem is going to sort of ease your punishment. He's going to take away your avera, but this child, Bathsheba's unborn child, that was conceived from this illicit or seemingly illicit relations, the child is going to die." So the pasuk says that Nason went home, and the child indeed was afflicted with some sort of disease, and the child became very sick. And for 7 days, David HaMelech was fasting and praying and doing what he can to ask Hashem for the child to be healed. And after 7 days, the child died, and David HaMelech got up, and he started eating and going back to his normal life. And the pasuk says that David HaMelech's servants asked him, "We don't understand. What do you, you know, for seven, while the kid was alive, even though he was sick, you were fasting and mourning as if he was dead. And now that he's dead, you're celebrating as if, you know, as if nothing happened. Like, what happened?" So David HaMelech responded, and this just goes to show, like, the degree of David HaMelech's belief and reliance on Hashem. David HaMelech said that the 7 days while he was sick, so I was hoping that, you know, if I do tshuva, if I pray to Hashem, so they can overturn the decree that this child is supposed to die. But now that he's dead, so what am I supposed to do? There's nothing to do anymore, so just carry on as normal. And the pasuk says that David HaMelech was consoled after he finished mourning her. He was consoled with his wife Bathsheba, and he loved her, and she became pregnant again, and she had another son, and he called that son Shlomo. And Nason HaNavi called him Yedidya, which is an interesting thing. He had two names. He had Shlomo and Yedidya. He had other names as well. Shlomo Malach had another name of Kaheles. He had another name of Ogur. Different names that Shlomo Malach had. But that's the story of the birth of Shlomo Malach. Be'ezus Hashem, on Sunday, next time we meet, we're going to see the continuation of the story of the question of the succession of David HaMelech. We said that there's going to be a ra mi beisecha, ra mi beisecha. The evil is going to come upon David from his household. So we're going to see what's the story exactly of this evil that comes upon David HaMelech from his household. And we're going to also see, David HaMelech said, as I mentioned before, that the rich man should pay four times the amount of the sheep. Yishalim arbatoyim. So Chazal tell us, Gemara says in Meseches Yoyma on Chafbez, the Gemara says that David HaMelech lost four children because of this story. And the first one is this baby, this first child of Bathsheba that died. And we're going to see the other three, Be'ezus Hashem, next week when you continue the story. All right, thank you very much for coming. And stand.